It's time to step into the Coming Out Lounge, a cool, safe space to be true to your sexual self, with your host, Rick Clemens. Rick has helped hundreds of people come out of the closet, and now each week he's bringing you cool insights for loving and accepting yourself, boosting your self-confidence, and living a guilt-free, purpose-filled life on the other side of the closet doors. Cuddle up with yourself and get ready for heartwarming coming out stories, ideas for living authentically, and tips for being fully self-expressed. Now here's your host, Coming Out Coach Rick.
Hey, Closet Busters. We are back once again on the Coming Out Lounge, where we step out, step up, and step into living our powerful truth each and every day, each and every moment, being exactly who we're meant to be in the world. And I'm really excited today because I've got one of those people who has found his way to be who he's meant to be in the world, whether he's being queer as folk, being his funny self, being a comedian, or doing the writing that he loves to do. He's one of my favorites from that beautiful show, Queer as Folk, and I can't wait to get into a conversation, find out what's going on, talk about how he supports the LGBTQ community. Welcome to the Coming Out Lounge podcast, Mr. Hal Sparks. Hey, Hal.
Thanks so much.
Hey, man, I'm just so glad to have you here. This has been my little endeavor for the last couple of years of just bringing some really cool peeps onto the podcast to talk about life, being LGBTQ or being allies. And I can't tell you how much it means to me to have people like you come on and share your stories, talk about what you're doing in your life. So let's kind of just dive right in.
Yeah.
You know, I know you've been interviewed hundreds of times about Queer as Folk and all that, and I don't want to kind of rehash some of that stuff, but what I do want to say is
it's never boring. Don't worry about it. Even if you want the same old story, I can still be interesting. That's one of my key talents.
Yeah. But here's a question I would love to, you know, just kind of delve into, because I was talking to I was talking to Bruce Valanche the other day. I'm getting ready to interview Judy Shepherd about her journey with Matthew and losing Matthew and everything. But it brought up a question of if some of the events that have happened in the past. So for instance, if Queer as Folk were to launch this year, what would be different about the show? What would be the angles? What would be the things we'd see that might be like, okay, now we're that new generation, so to speak?
Well, I certainly think it would deal more with trans issues. And I also think it would deal with building bridges racially in the gay community as well.
Mm-hmm.
There has been, anytime a group is marginalized by a greater part of society, the tendency is to have an acute awareness of that, to live constantly aware of that. And when you live that way, often you are less apt to reach out even across similar boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So marginalized groups, marginalized elements of society tend to bifurcate into smaller and smaller segments. And you can see this in sort of the straight white world, you know, if you want to put it that way. You know, there's the liberal allies like myself. And then on the complete other side of the arc, there's the religious fanatic crowd. Even though we share a race and a sexual preference,
right. We
don't necessarily crisscross at the club, you know, or in line at a restaurant and start building bridges. It's just a natural part of the, you know, the segmenting based on proclivities and philosophies and identities. And as we deal with identity politics more and more, I think that's where the drama is.
Yep.
And since it is a drama series, you know, it was never meant to be a pride march.
Right.
It was meant to be more valuable than that in many ways, in that it gave people a deeper view of the gay community, which is what allowed, I think, most people who were, you know, outsiders to it, to view it with a little more sympathy and understanding, because when it boiled down to it, love is love. You fall in love, you get your heart broken, you have friendships that work and don't work, you have power struggles within your family and in your relationships. And that's true of everyone. And the value, I think, more, you know, than anything, of course, was that a lot of straight people watching the show had that moment of recognition.
Yeah.
And that's the moment of recognition that we're in right now. Unfortunately, we're almost in a space of hyper, you know, segmentation within every group, because the sort of attempted bonding through intersectionality is actually in some ways created the exact opposite, that everybody is sort of gathering around the fire of their individual victimhood and not recognizing separate, you know, the bonds that exist.
I think this is where the bridging really needs to start happening, is I see this too, that, you know, especially in my own community, you know, I came out late in life, so I had to learn to build some bridges there myself, because here I am, this 36, 38 year old guy. Well, not anymore. I'm 50 something. But at that time, coming out, and I had to kind of build some bridges to go, okay, I do kind of fit in this community, but yet I didn't, because I didn't have the same experiences, you know?
That's right.
As I've walked through this fire in so many different ways, and then became professionally a coach and really do this kind of work all the time, I realized we continue to not build bridges within our community, yet we want to be building bridges with the rest of the world. And it's like, hey, wake up, folks. We need to kind of be mirroring what we want to build here. And of course, now in our world in general, all these bridges need to be built everywhere. So as a dad and having a young son, how are you starting to really influence his, you know, building bridges? And I know he's young. He's what, 5, 6 years old now?
Here's the thing. He's five. You don't have to. You know, most of the general view of, you know, the openness of kids and the push and pull, quite frankly, when they're rough with each other, when they're rude, when they're disrespectful, when they're angry, when they lash out, that's all just natural parts of the brain growing.
Sure.
You can't overlay adult human interaction too heavily onto a child. You can softly guide them towards being polite, being loving, being accepting, being, you know, and then also being safe about themselves, recognizing that not everybody out there has got their best interest in heart, and they've got the right to define their emotional and physical limits in their life. That being said, I don't have to. It's so funny when I see people trying to make up for, you know, generations of, if not millennia, although I think there's some fluctuation in there, of specified gender roles in a generation.
Yeah.
They try to clean it up in a, you know, like, we're going to just let every kid, at any moment of fantasy that they have, but we're going to encourage them to carry it to the furthest realm, insisting that they're trans or insisting that they're whatever, because ultimately the openness of the support will somehow make them feel better to be themselves. And the opposite is happening, unfortunately.
Yeah.
What you have to do is not dive in. If they ultimately are trans, or if they ultimately do express their gender in a broader way, they will grow into that without your interference or your insistence on teaching them that words don't mean what they used to mean, because it won't be their experience when they're out in the world. That's the tough part. You know, you can teach your kid to, you know, assume gender is a, you know, a social construct or something made by society, but that's not going to be the experience they're going to have in the rest of the world. So what you have to do is have them, teach them to respect themselves and know that no label, no matter how important even to their political movement, overshadows their individual worth. Therefore, no bad name that they can be called will do that either.
Absolutely. I've encountered this with my own daughters. They're 21 and 17 now. But they have been in, well, of course, they've been in my life since they were born, but they've been through this transitional life of me coming out at 36, and then they were 18 months old and not quite 5 and a half when I came out. So they pretty much have grown up in this fluid space of, okay, we've got a heterosexual mother, we have a gay dad, now they have another gay father in their world. And I've watched them both go experiment in their own ways. And at times, I even caught myself as what I thought was a very open-minded gay guy going, okay, well, you need to decide who you are. Are you bi? Are you not? And then when I realized, the more I pulled away from that and just said, okay, I want you to just be happy. Can you just be happy?
Right.
And the rest of this will kind of flow. And, you know, it's taken me some time to get to that space in myself to be able to do that with my kids. But I think when we allow our children to be this way, because we don't need to define, we don't need to bring up the things that, quote unquote, we got left out of in our own childhood and, you know, lived through our child, they actually become really healthy human beings in so many ways.
Right. A lot of people are in the danger right now of, you know, especially very socially liberal people who really do care about these issues, put themselves in the danger of effectively being the emotional or psychosexual version of a parent that went through the depression. They have the danger of becoming poor dad in the rich dad, poor dad story, because they're so concerned about, you know, conserving space and conserving money and not overreaching and being afraid that the next fall is going to happen, that they end up teaching their children not to strive, not to believe that they can be rich, not to believe that they can be powerful, important, you know, help people actually make, that they could make a difference in the world. The difference is that when you go through, you know, a depression like era, the whole thing is save your pennies and don't invest in anything that might get you out of this mess, because it really probably won't. And even if it does, it'll only be temporary. And there's an emotional version of that that I think a lot of people are going through right now. in that the shock of the AIDS crisis, the shock of the battle for marriage equality, while the end result has been extraordinary and beautiful, also came with a price that is not unlike the PTSD that goes with war.
Yes.
And there are a lot of people carrying around those scars, and some of which, by the way, aren't even their own. They're assumed or borrowed scars.
Well, they're carried on. They're little gremlin voices that continue to carry on from what they've heard in the past. I mean, been overlaid. It's the blueprint.
Your grandparents tell you to, you know, make sure you have two nickels to rub together at all times. And then the first day you don't, instead of going, all right, I don't have, my bills are paid. I'm good. I'm, you know, this is something I'll ruffle through. You go, gee, this is what they were talking about. The end is coming.
Yeah.
And there really is an importance, especially when you're striving for more rights and more open, not just open-mindedness, but open-heartedness. And that's really what I think the LGBTQ movement is more about, especially as rights grow. That's also the transition that's going on. I think queer folk would probably have to reflect that, is the difficulty of being at the moment when marriage is legal in all 50 states. So now it's a philosophical or emotional question, just like straight people have about it. And as straight people are moving away from marriage, will that be reflected in the gay community? Mm-hmm. Is it more or less important because of that? And then on the other side, in every state, you know, you don't have the protection of not being fired because you're gay.
Right,
so
exactly.
I think that's one where the right don't exist. And on a legislative level, on a marching level, have to be established. There's a lot of drama and back and forth. And the problem is they tend to get fused.
Well,
people tend to not be able to separate them.
Absolutely. And this is where the problems arise, is because there's no consistency in what's happening right now. I speak on panels for PFLAG all the time. And these are the kind of questions we're starting to get more and more of. It's like, okay, so you can be married, but you can get fired, or you can be out, but you can't be trans and at work. It's like, yes, do you people understand now? And I'm so glad I get the beautiful opportunity to do this, because I'm speaking in front of college students and university students who I'm hoping will step forward and start to go, wait, this is really, really screwed up. But when you can't have the consistency of all these things, yes, marriage equality, I'm so glad we got that, and I'm happily now married to my husband, but there's so many things that came along with that that are still inconsistent that I guess that's how we'll keep politicians busy for years to come, but it's just kind of crazy.
Well, I think it'll be much quicker than, say, you know, women's suffrage or the civil rights movement has gone. I mean, none of that is over, but it is certainly light years ahead on a legal level.
Yep.
The problem that a lot of African Americans have in this country right now is not the lack of rights. It's the unequal application of those rights.
Yes.
That is the problem. That is really what Black Lives Matter and all that conversation is really about right now. It is not that Black people have fewer opportunities technically, or Black people have fewer that they can be discriminated against technically for things, because they can't. You cannot discriminate against race when you're renting or selling a home, any of those aspects. But there is an unequal application of that equal protection that constantly is dogging them nearly every turn. Mm-hmm. And gay people especially, and trans people, are sort of emblematic of that, because numerically they're a very small part of the society, incredibly small.
Yeah.
Almost so small that they could individually sue their way into each of these situations never have to work again.
Yeah, no doubt.
Once the law is there. There's so few. However, they have become sort of the standard bearer of the extremity of the circumstance. I kind of put it up there with like free speech, the idea that it was ultimately Larry Flint that probably made the biggest strides towards free speech in this country.
Yeah.
Now, not most of the people that had problems with free speech weren't pornographers. They didn't run Hustler magazine. They weren't, you know, they didn't have a wife who wore a nurse's outfit all the time, you know, and they didn't literally, you know, they were the people who were fighting for free speech issues were not him. However, he was the furthest down the road to make the point that this is the top of your comfort level. This is where it tests your comfort level. And you have to understand the difference between this and communist propaganda sold by the Soviet Union. And, you know, this is different. And when trans people are allowed to be themselves, you can rest assured that you, no matter what your proclivity is, in your genuine life, are free to be yourself. If they are not, then which parts of them are not?
Right.
What's the uncomfortable part? Then you start getting into, maybe this is why people are fired, because they're dressed too scantily and when they go out on the weekends with their friends or their girlfriends or whatever, because this has to deal with our own discomfort about our own sexuality, about our own, you know, your boss has his issues. And if he can understand that legally it is his responsibility or her responsibility to not fire somebody because they're gay or trans, then ultimately it keeps in check their own personal issues about it. And they ultimately, hopefully over time, this is what you always hope for, is that by being around people who are gay or trans, they will realize they're good workers. They do their job. That's all I'm hiring people to do anyways. The rest right. of their life is none of my goddamn business.
Exactly. And it is none of their business. I remember early on when I first was in Southern California back in the early 90s, I ended up working for a company in Orange County who was a software developer. And one of our support individuals was a transgender female. And we embraced her. She was just phenomenal on the phones. And, you know, she kind of stood out only because she had transitioned later in life and she had already started going bald. So when she chose to grow her hair out and to, you know, become who she really was, she had like this very bald head. But other than that, she was a stunning beauty. And I remember how much we embraced her as a company because we knew this was who we were as a company. We did have a lot of LGBT people in the company at that point. But when someone is allowed to be who they are, it has nothing else to do with what they do at work other than allow them to be who they are in their work environment so that then they can leave and go home to be who they are in all the rest of their life. Plain and simple.
Sure.
That's the way I look
at it. Yeah. The odd part is that, you know, thanks to the Obama administration, I mean, gay and trans people can now serve openly in the military.
Yep.
That was not an accident. If you read David Axelrod's book, you know, obviously, Obama was for gay marriage from day one, but recognized if he said gay marriage and not civil union, he never would have gotten elected. And the person who would have gotten elected never would have let this stuff happen. That would have been the lockdown. That's why I don't have problems with politicians being Machiavellian at times, because it is a necessity. You have to be, you know, you're not always going to win through bullishness by just, you know, the force of the idea. If the country isn't ready for it, softer guidance may be necessary. And I think he and his administration don't quite get enough credit for that.
Credit
but
for
I also
right
think
way.
It's kind of fascinating. Yeah. That the fascinating part that, you know, trans people and gay people can serve ultimately in the military now in every capacity.
Yeah.
Even combat.
Yep.
And yet there are still laws where you can be fired when you work at an insurance firm or a convenience store or some area where these people enjoy the protections of the freedom that military members and their families give to all of us, but they don't have to live up to the protection of that.
It's insane.
This is the discomfort. Yeah, it's silly. It's an absurdity. And it is also, in my estimation, a profound lack of respect for what freedom truly is. Freedom is not your ability to create a small, insular, you know, protected community against everybody else in the country who make you uncomfortable.
Right.
And there seem to be, ironically, people on the right and then in the social justice movement that almost seem to think exactly the same way in that regard.
Yeah.
And the importance is, like you've been saying, is those bridges. I got news for it. These bridges, these when they first get built, are creaky and crappy and dangerous and will break every so often, but they need to be built and rebuilt again with the level of, you know, you cannot sort of force a bridge. You can blow one up really easily, but the building takes a long time.
It does take a long time. And, you know, as I work with my clients who are typically coming out of the closet, and it's kind of interesting because now my business has grown to where it's not just individuals coming out of the closet because of their sexual orientation. Now I work with entrepreneurs who are like, okay, I really want to take a stand and say, just kind of corporate. I want to go be my own person.
Sure.
You know, it's the same journey. And as I've worked with them, you know, one of the things I say is when you get confronted by that person who is like adamantly against you, one of the most powerful questions in a very loving way to start to build the bridge is to simply say, you know, I'm just curious, what is it about me, my life, what I'm doing that really is making you so uncomfortable that you can't live? And it's a pretty powerful question because that stops the person to have to really think about, okay, what is this? Because then they have to go deep within themselves and go, okay, well, what is it that is making me uncomfortable? And I've had this conversation with numerous people on my own fronts. And as I work with clients, I continue to have them use that question because first it's a stopgap question, kind of stops that initial thought. They have to go think about it. And then it kind of brings that
pattern interrupt.
Yeah, it's a very deep pattern interrupt. And it kind of shows that you are willing to have a conversation. You're willing to, quote unquote, as Brené Brown would say, be in the arena with someone. It's really powerful. So I'm curious how, you know, and I know you've done beautiful stuff, not only in your work, but the way you are an activist in so many fronts. What was the burning desire to just really start to stand for some of these movements? I mean, where did that start for you?
You know, well, I think on a couple fronts. One is I've never felt like I have to settle for the way things are. That an idea that things should be, I'm a big fan of a level playing field because that's the only way I know I'm damn good at something.
Right.
I should be competing against people who have every shot in life. That's the only way I know if I'm any good. If I've got a head start for some stupid reason, then do you really know if you were any good? It's like being the tallest guy playing basketball to some degree all the time. You know, you got to be honest. There may be people on the court who are better than you. You're just closer to the rim, you know, and that's not quite, you know, you'll never really get the satisfaction of knowing that you've done something. So that's always been exciting to me. And I've never understood why anybody should be hamstrung, you know, early on by anything. The other thing too is, and I'll always bring it back to, you know, the band Kiss, and they're the reason why I'm not pumping gas in Kentucky, because I always found their music to be in, you know, like, this may be odd for some people, but I always like very, you know, believe in yourself kind of music. And with that, I grew up in Kentucky where the whole Knights in Satan Service or, you know, Kids in Satan Service nonsense was being pushed about them. It had nothing to do with who they really were, but it was sold as it was a broad thought form that was everywhere. It was ubiquitous around me. Here was my favorite band. This is the music I loved when I was 7 years old, and people around me are telling me it's evil. And I knew this not to be true. I recognized that A, they never listened to it. B, they don't care about it. It's not their ears I'm listening with. So what difference should it make whether or not I listen to it? And they had a huge vested interest in me not listening to it and me not being able to have access to the music and be around it. And I saw this happen with band after band, and then into the 80s with the PMRC, you know, the Parents Music Resource Council, and the labeling of records, and this idea that, you know, these ideas are dangerous and kids can't handle these ideas being put into their head. P.S. We're going to spend the rest of our time putting ideas into kids' heads that will ultimately scar them against their gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender.
Well, and then, you roll forward to today. You roll forward to today with everything that's available. And if you were to compare how kids gain access to stuff today through social media and the things they can get their ears around and their faces around, their eyes around, it's like drastically different when you and I were growing up and Kiss was like at the top of the charts. You know, it's like, hello, let's wake up and realize this isn't anything that's really that far out of, you know, historical ways of being.
Norms.
It's the norms.
This is kabuki theater. This is this is pop music at its stand. People said the same thing about Mozart, and everybody's going, did I compare Kiss and Mozart? I absolutely did, and I always will. But the idea is that I grew up with that sort of, hey, wait a second attitude. You know, when I was a kid, when I would hear people just openly lie from a position of disdain and ignorance about something that I loved very dearly. And I think at that moment, I became aware of my bridge with people who were told all the time that they don't love what they love or they're not allowed to love what they love. And so, you know, when it came to gay rights, it was an obvious, you know, why wouldn't you support people being who they are, being allowed to be who they are and love who they want to love and have their hearts broken just like you do and listen to a song with the same, you know, vibrant sorrow or vibrant joy that you get to experience, you know, secretly in a basement too, you know, that's the funny part of, about all of it was that it was a constant awareness, I think, that grew over time that I was part of a, you know, a level of society that's kind of looking at society. I think maybe people in the closet might have a particularly good perspective on life that makes them ultimately have the potential to be more successful than other people, since they are looking, most people look at life head on because they're allowed to and because that's the only solution they can come up. Other people, I think, look at life on a perpendicular level. They watch it pass them by. They don't ever engage. They just kind of stand on the side of the road watching it go and go, wow, that's a lot of noise. And I think people in the closet, and I think people who lived more of an underground existence or an underground belief, you know, were kind of outsiders for that reason. you have kind of an angular view on life. You're not, you know, 90 degree angles. You're 45 degree angle of everything. Yep. You're involved, but you're also always a viewer, always an observer, because you're just not in line. It's like being Native American and watching the fight between Black people and white people in the United States. Mm-hmm. It gives you a different perspective.
Well, I always say we're the outliers. We're the outliers who consistently, at least where I come from, I feel like I'm an outlier who constantly is curious. I just want to be curious. Mm-hmm. Even with people who like piss me off and who I completely don't align with, I don't allow myself to not align with them until I have satisfied my curiosity that there's no other possibility, you know? And even then, I know there's no quote unquote absolute no possibility. But once I know, okay, I know I've explored this to the best of my ability, and no, I don't want to play with you in your world. So we're cool. But I encourage people that I work with, and then when I'm speaking on stage and even through this podcast, if I could give anybody one really great piece of advice as they're coming through the closet doors or hiding in their closet, whatever that is, never lose your curiosity. Because the moment you lose your curiosity, then you become like so many other people out there who are trying to hold you in your box. You suddenly just say, let's march in time. Let's just be the same. Let's just, you got to maintain the curiosity. And that's when you can open up. That's when you can have that open-mindedness. You can have that open heart. You can look at things from a different space of love and caring go, let's figure this out.
Yeah. Right. And look at how many people that you view with disdain who have closed minds and closed hearts and do not tolerate, you know, mistaken or damaged thought from other people. Mm-hmm. And you go, wait a minute, you are so uncharitable. You are so hateful towards these people. And then in your mark, you really have to work to not become one.
Yes.
You know, that happens to a lot of people. You know, they, you know, it happens when people find a new religion. Mm-hmm. It happens when people get out of a religion and finally become the atheist or whatever. And they, instead of going, I want to show people how life is much better if you don't have this kind of thought all the time, or if you don't believe that their system, look how much more fun and joyful and good my life is. But they don't. They become as sour and as dour and as negative as the very people they were fighting, because those people are, you know, sour and dour and negative, So that's why I like the Pride movement as well. You know, I certainly think it's one of the healthiest expressions of out people over time. And not everybody is, you know, up for being in gold shorts in a parade, you know, every year. But the idea that there's a Pride month is, I think, incredibly healthy, because most people don't allow themselves to have pride in themselves, period. Yep. I mean, much less gay people. But I don't think most people like that, which is why, by the way, a lot of straight people,
absolutely,
who, you know, don't participate in it or are upset or made incurious by it. They get, you know, they get kind of put off by it, because they're not allowed to be proud of themselves for anything either, because their family told them to go sniff themselves whenever they tried something.
Right.
You know, life has a hand on everybody.
One of the most awestruck I ever was when I first had become a life coach and I started doing a lot of different work. I started getting a little bit of exposure. I started being on some stages, and I had my first, like, you know, hater really come after me in a public venue.
Sure.
And he was like, you're causing people to sin. You're breaking up homes, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I was prepared for this. I knew it was coming. I stood there and I looked at him and I said, you know, I really, really hear you, man, because there's something happening for you where my ability to help people feel pride about who they are is something that somebody told you you couldn't do, you were not able to do. And I'm curious, I'm curious, man, who told you in some way, shape, or form in your life that you haven't been able to be who you are? And he didn't know what to do with it, because he was expecting the immediate, like, fuck you, get the hell out of my, and that's what he was expecting. But when I put it into those common terms of, man, you've been hurt. You know, one of my favorite phrases is hurt people hurt people. And when I took him to that space of, we're having our little come to Jesus talk, so to speak, and I'm human just like you. I'm a brother just like you. I'm a guy just like you. And somebody's hurt you, man. He didn't know where to go. And actually, it kind of quieted him down. And he didn't apologize, but he definitely walked away without making a whole lot more stink. You know, it was pretty amazing to see something like that happen. So
you see that outreach, that lashing out with the trans cis back and forth linguistically.
Absolutely.
And the answer to that, and it's hard to tell somebody who's hurting, and felt like they've been told not to be themselves and not, you know, to each other. The answer is not to, you know, assign an alternate label to someone in an effort to show them that they are marginalized, to make them feel you're hurt, because they never will. Mm-hmm. It is your application. They come, especially if somebody comes from what is ever the dominant group.
Yep.
Any, you know, dominant groups don't feel the punches, not the same way. They never do. So the attempt at doing that isn't. But what you can do is touch their heart.
Yes.
And that's what has worked so well, you know, as the LGBT community transitions out of, you know, a modern historical box, which, by the way, hasn't always been there. I don't care what anybody says. Mm-hmm. The Abrahamic traditions are the religions that, you know, have caused the most difficulty for gay people over the centuries and millennia, haven't always been the dominant form. And there were times when gay people and, you know, multi-gendered kind of characters, beings, creatures, however you want to call them, were viewed by society as special in different tribal environments and all kinds of stuff. So we did this as part of an emotional cleanup while progress kicked in.
Yep.
And it really helps progress if everybody has clearly defined labels. And that's what the machinery of it was for. Men act this way, women act this way. They have this many kids. They take three roads to work every day and don't really veer off the path. They take 2 weeks of vacation and they shut the f*** up the rest of the time. Anybody outside that is a commie because you're stopping progress. And that's how things have operated for a couple of hundred years. And you can't even fault society at certain points as it tried to solve starvation, as it tried to, you know, build roads out to the middle of nowhere, as, you know, the sprawl of humanity created the necessity for more crops and all that stuff, for reacting that way. Like, you know, it's almost as if the entire society has been the Donner Party for a long time. Like, look, everybody's got to act and do their job right, or you're going to get eaten.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't, you know, and so you can shake your fist at the, you know, at the racism, sexism, you know, homophobia of the past to some degree, but you can also know that it's reflective of a period in history, specifically a growth towards industrialism that's been very specific over the last, you know, couple of hundred years, especially, that's going away.
Yes.
That is fading out. It's that, not how we're going to live.
And that's why there's fear. That's why fear shows up.
That's right.
Because we, you know, I have a guy that I speak with on PFLAG panels and love him to death. He's 72 years old. He's a, and he, when he gets up to speak, he says this every time. He goes, I'm as straight as the paint on that window. I'm as white as they come. I have no dog in this fight. But what I know is people are people and everyone deserves to be exactly who they are. That's coming from that generation who typically you wouldn't hear something like that come out of their mouths.
That's right.
Because
that's
we have
more
to move
coming from him.
Yeah. But what, that's why we have to move through these generational shifts and these movements and these historical perspectives. And this is where I think Queer as Folk, for all the hubbub it made in lots of different ways on both sides of the fence, this is where I think it really helped start to set a new tone. Yes, did it reflect some of the extremes of the gay community? Of course it did. Did it reflect some of the truths about the gay community? Of course it did. But it gave a wide picture of, okay, there's lots of different ways. And the thing that used to frustrate me with my own community, who would bash and go, well, this is just making us look like we're just a bunch of whores. We all just sit around and get f***ed and we have all these multiple partners, blah, blah, blah. I said, yes, but... That's part of our culture.
Yeah.
It's not all of our culture, but guess what? It's the same thing in the heterosexual community. It just isn't being talked about. So let's get real.
Right.
Let us be the flag bearers. Let us be the humanitarians that say, yes, we're going to stake a stand and we're going to say, this is part of our culture. It's not everything we stand for, but it is part of who we are. And guess what? It's not really any different. So let's start building that bridge and having those conversations. And that's where
and not to forget, I did play half of the first legally married gay couple on American television.
Exactly.
It was also HIV positive and negative, and are, for all practical purposes, as far as the story was told, still together.
Yes.
You know, as much as there's a lot of attention, and this is how, you know, most attention flows anyways. It flows to the most shocking. It flows to the most fearful, those kind of things. But the reality is the club lifestyle served as the single lifestyle, you know, does before people settle into or move into either droll relationships that are representative of where they're not going, or, you know, accumulative relationships that are forces to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm.
People getting together because they met at a club and sticking together for however long it takes to wear that out, or people meeting in a circumstance and falling in love for a great long while and becoming important couples that everybody else sort of strives around. That's what happens in relationships, period.
Exactly.
And it's now at a point where that can happen to gay people as well. And that was what the show reflected. The reality was that even, you know, as pivotal as the Brian character was, he was almost like the trunk of the Christmas tree. Very little of it had to do with him. A lot of the ornamentations and all that other stuff, he didn't really grow. He never changing part. But the seasons changed around him.
Yes.
And became more indicative of where things were headed. And so I was very proud of the fact that, you know, we did a lot, Bobby Gantt and I, to make sure that this relationship we had on screen represented the depth of what was possible in a relationship. And, you know, it's why the characters made love facing each other.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, that was, it was a specific choice.
It reflected so much of what is really truth in the gay male culture. There are so many gay men in that hit that late 30s, early 40s, mid 40s life where they suddenly do have those wake up calls of, I'm having this urge to really be in the relationship. And the show reflected what it was like to have those cravings and want to have those connections in the way that they could. But nobody else had been trained this in any form of medium to show that we are very much the same as, you know, Joe and Sally next door and Tom and Sue down the street. We want these things, but guess what, folks? Nobody taught us how to do this except heteronormative sort of schooling and shows and everything else. And I believe in my heart of hearts that these are the things that each time we get the opportunity to show from the extremes to the middle of the road, this is where the bridges get built.
I agree. Yeah, it's funny because the Bill and Sally down the street are the people who watched Queer as Folk and recognized, saw themselves reflected in that show as well. And, you know, I used to get asked all the time, like, how I got ready for the, you know, for playing in Queer as Folk and stuff. And they were more like kind of wink and a nod.
Right.
Did you try it kind of thing? It's as if it, whenever you, you know, play somebody who does drugs, the assumption is how method did you go?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or some activity that you may or may not participate in. And, you know, what I would always say is, they're like, did you go to gay clubs and hang out and that kind of stuff? And I went, no, because I wouldn't respond emotionally the way Michael would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, that's any more than gay people would go to a straight club and go, okay, I know what straight people are like. You just see them doing stuff, but you wouldn't necessarily know how they felt.
Right.
But if a gay person in a gay club saw someone that they felt like they wanted to talk to but were afraid to, they would know exactly how to play a straight character who felt the same thing.
Exactly.
And so all of Michael's emotional stuff that he went through all came from relationships that I had, and I was able to build, you know, and use those emotions as an actor based on my own experience. I think we put too much emphasis on the similarity of the external.
Yes. We put too much emphasis on the sexual orientation piece. I mean, this is something I say all the time when I'm on a stage. I'm Rick, and I am a dad. I'm a businessman, I'm da-da-da-da, and I purposely go through this whole list of stuff and about 20 into it and go, oh, and by the way, I happen to be gay, because that is not the thing. Now, that's for me. There are other people who being gay is like a really high thing for them, and I applaud them for that. But the truth is, my sexual orientation has very little to do with most of what else I do in my life. Yes, I am a business guy who happens to do a lot of work in this arena, but it has very little to do with what I do. And, you know, to your reference there about the people down the street who ended up watching Queer as Folk, when my book came out a few months ago and a lot of my heterosexual friends started reading it, I couldn't believe how many of them came back to me and said, okay, I know this is a gay coming out book, it's how to come out and all this stuff, but this really touched me because I saw parts of myself in ways that I never saw as a heterosexual person, because I realized, wow, this journey and how you came out and some of the things you were doing is exactly what I was doing, but I never knew how to really confront it and own it and be it. And this is where we need to come together and realize we are so much more similar than we are different. It's so much more.
I, you know, it's funny. It's so interesting to me that, you know, the root words of hetero and homo, you know, meaning different or opposite and the same, is so ironic considering society's perception.
Yep.
You know, is that, you know, our group is the same. This is a homosexual group because we all have sex the same way. And then you're the heterosexual group because you guys have sex different than we do. That's really how the perception goes. It has very little to do with sort of male and female at that point. It's just like, I don't understand that and I don't want to.
Yeah.
That always, to me, is fascinating. And I think to your point, there is a, everybody has some version of coming out.
Yes.
In their life.
Yep.
And most people just don't. That's just the reality. It's like, I'm extremely fortunate, and also I take great pride and responsibility for my life where I don't have that issue. Mm-hmm. Not because it hasn't been there. It's just because I did it so early. It doesn't matter. Everything I wanted to do in my life, including be a comedian, I started doing it when I was 15 years old. And my family, everybody was against it. I mean, my mom was, you know, in abstract supportive. Yep. She's like, you can be and do whatever you want. She didn't actually expect me to take her up on it, kind of. You know, no parent does. They're like, you can be anything you want. And you go, I want to be a tattoo artist. They're like, wait a second. You know, like, there's always, but I'm really good at it. I'm a great artist. Cool. You should work for an ad agency and make a real living and not live and work in a place near the airport where you'll get Hep C. Like, that's where parents' brains go. And you can't fault them for that. At 15, I didn't, you know, my motto has always been, you know, care enough not to give a shit.
Yep.
Meaning you have to care about yourself and what you're trying to do, not to give a shit about the haters, not to give a shit about other people's opinions until it's together. You can have criticism, but you can really only have it once it's really there. And if you're half yourself, you haven't come out as who you are. People aren't criticizing you. Mm-hmm. They're criticizing a version of you that you show to the world and another version of you that you show to yourself.
Yes.
They have no idea, and neither do you, who you really are. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Stephanie Miller, you know, I did her radio show for ages, and she finally came out after a good long while. She hid very closely that she's a lesbian, you know, and everybody said, what was she like before she came out? And I'm like, I have no idea, because I knew I was getting a face that whole time.
Yeah.
I don't know who that person is. I know who their mask is. I could describe their mask fairly well. But that doesn't tell me anything.
Right. And I think that's where we as humans, we don't realize sometimes how much we are having relationships with masks and not really the person.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, I think that's a really good place to kind of start to bring this all together. Hal, you've been so great to just, I could talk to you for hours. We could have like a 4-hour show here.
I love being able
to just jam with someone like this. But one of the things I'm always curious about is what someone would say to someone who, and again, this can go, I'm starting to get a lot of listeners that aren't just LGBTQ because they know I'm the guy. I mean, I put myself on a mission to make coming out everybody's journey. Everybody's coming out of something.
Right.
So let's be real about this. Let's realize we're all closeted about something in our lives. So let's start uncloseting. Let's start stepping forward. Let's start being who we really are so those masks can drop off. That being said, if you could, you know, really inspire someone here in the last couple of minutes that we have to go be who they are, what would be that piece of wisdom you would love to leave with the listeners?
Well, it's just, you know, I would say the same thing to somebody who has a dream to, you know, start a business that they've always wanted to do or move someplace and go live, you know, someplace like if you want to live in the south of France or you want to do something like that, that I would give them the same advice I would give to someone who's coming out about their sexuality or their gender. And that is, A, not everybody has to be on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Your dream's value or your existence is not predicated on other people's opinion of it. So seeking it specifically is not always necessary. And, you know, I grew up in the South. It's not always safe for people to come out.
Yeah.
So the idea that, yeah, everybody should just kick their door open and, you know, because of something they've heard or read someplace and that they'll be okay is not necessarily the case. Do your time your way, be you through the whole transition. Because it's not just flipping a switch on. It's not just tearing off a mask. You have a lot invested in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, let this be a time of germination and growing. And when you have that, if you tell somebody and you live in Owensboro, Kentucky, or you live in, you know, Franklin, Indiana, that you want to, you know, live in a, you know, open a cafe in Italy one day, they're going to do everything they can to tell you how stupid that is right away. Because that's what they heard when they were told their dream.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing is true of gender and sexuality. Everybody, when they expressed themselves and they were young, may have been hit in the face with a rake emotionally because of the response from people around them. So my thing is, you know, it's sort of like a trust but verify. You only have a responsibility to yourself about your gender, your sexual identity, your sexual preference, any of that, and your entrepreneurial or emotional or career goals or your financial goals or any of those. Work on them. Focus on them. Have a very distinct plan for yourself. Make one, you know, write a map out.
I always say, write the business plan for your life. Go spend the time putting that together. And that's actually one of the exercises I have my clients do. And they kind of look at me weird or, you know, and they're like, what do you mean? I said, seriously, what you're about to do coming out, it's a whole nother piece of the business plan for your life. So I want you to really go think about it. I want you to think about what it's going to cost, what kind of support you need, what do you need to invest in, where do you need to spend some time doing work on yourself? Because this is where we start to grow. And I love that you use the terminology germinate. This isn't something that you just wake up one day and say, ah, oh, fuck it, I'm coming out. Now, in a way, you kind of do.
That's right.
But you got to spend the time.
Back so long, right?
But you
also don't know who you are. You can't possibly because you are now a person with 100% more freedom. It is, you know, you have to understand there are new responsibilities that come with it. There are new experiential realities that come with it. You have to protect yourself and know that it will take you time to digest this because no man steps in the same river twice.
Yes.
You know, nobody has ever read a book twice because you're different after the first time you read it. Mm-hmm. You just are. You are not the same being. You know, when I first started lifting a year and a half ago, I'm on my Disney series and I'm trying to gain muscle mass for the show.
Right.
I couldn't do it like other people did it, like where you just eat a bunch of stuff, do a bunch of lifting, get all puffy and then take some diuretics and cut to look good on camera. So I was shooting all the time.
Right.
I was constantly filming. So I had to maintain through the whole thing. So the process became, you know, I had to set a goal for myself.
Yeah.
You know, I can bench press like 225 pounds now. But if you'd asked me before, when I first started on that plan, could I bench press 225? I'd say no, because I'm not that person yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I now can bench press 225. But the version of me that existed a year ago is gone. For all practical purposes, in some cases, never existed because it was the version of me minus this.
Yes.
And I think that's true when people are coming out, is that I don't know that people can be aware. You think you're always you, but you're not. You're always growing.
Yeah.
And in that growth, I think you owe it to yourself the space to go, I'm going to grow through this coming out process. I'm going to grow through setting these goals. I'm going to, you know, and there's no clock. There is no clock. Mm-hmm. It is just you. This is your life and your terms. Just, you know, allow it to be you. That's what the whole point anyways.
That
why
is
come
the whole
out
point.
And to put on another mask.
You know, as I've talked to people and worked with them, and this is a beautiful note to end on, is that, you know, really embrace just being you and knowing that you daily evolves and it shifts and it changes. But one of the things that you just said that is just so pivotal is... You that you will be a week from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, on the other side of that closet door is going to be so dynamically different than the person you are in that closet. And that's something a lot of people don't prepare for because they're like, okay, I'm going to come out. Yes, it's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. And then you don't realize that as you've done that, then you're going to be something completely different because you're going to have a different lens on the world. You're going to stand for some different things. You're going to find yourself participating in things. And I'm not just talking, you know, sexual stuff. I'm talking about how you're going to show up in the community, how you're going to show up in the world, you know? And so this is one area that I truly spend a lot of time with people on of, okay, now I get that this is important, but let's talk about future you. What is future Hal going to look like when, you know, a year or two from now, he's doing something different in his role as an actor, writer, and director? How is that going to look? How is that going to feel? Not that we can predict, but I want to prepare people for that stuff of you're going to be dynamically different and dynamically even more beautiful in your own way a year from now. So let's just embrace that this journey is ever moving, ever shaping, ever flowing. So
that's right. If we weren't assholes yesterday, we wouldn't need tomorrow.
Exactly.
There's a point where your growth, you know, your growth is the point, is the entire purpose.
Yeah.
And I like watching that happen.
Yes.
I mean, it's part of, like, my stand-up is based on, at root, understanding, helping people understand something that they may have either overlooked or bypassed or assumed was different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what acting is for. A lot of times, it's what music is for. But it's also, you know, more and more the tools we use that people, when they create a business or they do something like that, that's more and more what it's for as well, is that you're allowing people to understand something better. I have a better understanding because I can plan my day better, or I've read this you know, like read your book or whatever on, you know, on getting their life together. I now understand how I tick or the mistakes that I'm making so that I know how, no longer have to make them. Awesome. Then when I no longer make them, I'm no longer that person.
Exactly.
I now have new tools, new experiences that I get to have. And my lens, like you said, on the world is totally different. And until you move through that phase, you really have no idea what life has in for you.
And
you're just pretending.
So really quick before we wrap up here, tell everybody what you're working on. I know you got a lot of stuff in the works. So you've been doing lab rats.
Yeah.
You've got all sorts of stuff. You're out on tour right now. So what's like, you know, before we just, I'm going to kind of position this before we started recording. He's like, I feel like I've just emptied. And so now I'm ready to fill up. What are you going to fill up with next?
Yeah, I just filmed a special, new stand-up special last week in San Francisco at Cobb's, which is one of my favorite clubs in the country. And when I do that, I completely clear the decks comedically and just go back to topic, not written jokes, not, you know, exaggerated forms or preconceived stuff. I go back to topic and speak my heart for a while until it basically boils down to the essence of where the jokes are and where the thoughts are. So it's probably a 7-month process when I, you know, I'm on the road back and forth, writing and crafting and putting the show together and editing and creating. It's really, it's a lot of fun. And then, you know, I'm a dad. So every day I get to, you know, take a deep, shocking breath at the extraordinariness that is the existence of a child, you know, and I'm now a director because I direct on Lab Rats. And so that's opened up a lot for me because I'm now on the DGA and I can now direct all kinds of things. And so I've set a different path for myself. Again, I will this time next year, I will be a filmmaker because I will have finished. We're going to shoot in late June on a feature next year that I wrote. And so in doing that, again, I don't recognize me right now in a year. In a year from now, I will have had an experience under my belt that is, you know, in some people's lives, once in a lifetime. Other people take it on as their mantle and that's all they do. But when you finish, you know, it's like a marathon or swimming the English Channel. Or doing a marathon, then swimming the English Channel with a film crew on your back and an actor who's very emotionally upset, dragging you under. So there's, you know, the extraordinariness of that experience will kind of give me that shift. And so this is sort of my coming out as a filmmaker, as it were, in that regard. So
That's awesome, man.
Super excited about that. That's really been my focus. And so I do 4 short films between now and the end of the year as camera tests and effects tests that go into the feature next year. It's both learning and experimenting. So I do that the rest of the year while I'm touring.
That's great.
And then, you know, and then I start gearing up for next year, and then we'll be shooting Lab Rats and I'll be directing on there you know, intermittently through there. So it's a lot of stuff. It's
a lot of stuff, but that's what helps us grow and continue to step into exactly what we're put here on this earth to do. So that's awesome. Okay. So when can we expect the comedy thing to be out? Before the end of the year?
It'll probably be out by Christmas. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. Awesome.
I mean, the edit will probably be done in a month or so, but I haven't, Netflix would probably be the natural place for it, but I'm exploring other avenues just because I would rather. So it might just be on my YouTube Red channel and just let it go to the world that way these days.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
There's a lot. People can follow me on Twitter and that's
We will have everything up on the show page for everybody to follow you. And I just want to personally say, Hal, you've really given of yourself today. You've given like a whole hour of your time, man. You've given some great information. I know I've been touched by this experience. I just know my listeners will really take a lot of great nuggets out of this. It's inspiring not only on who they are, but also on how they can show up in the world and pursue their passions and be who they want to be and stand for what they want to stand for. And you've warmed my heart and I'm sure you'll warm their hearts. So thanks for being here with us today, man.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
All right, cool. Hey, 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 Closet Dwellers and Coming Out Lounge listeners, I wanted to invite you to check something out. You know, for all the years that I've been a Coming Out coach, one thing I've learned is sometimes people come to do the work with me and they only need a little bit of help to get over something very particular and very important to them. It could be reconciling their religion and sexuality. Maybe it's learning how to have the difficult conversations where they say, I'm gay. Possibly it could be, oh my God, I'm out of the closet, but now how do I do this same-sex dating and mating sort of thing? Well, what I can tell you is throughout the years, there are common things that show up over and over and over again. And what I've heard most from my clients and listeners of the podcast is, I want a way to work with you just on these particular subjects. Yay, I am so excited because I've taken the action and I've made this possible. So how do you find out about these particular programs? You go to thecomingoutcoach.com, or if you're on the show page right now listening to the podcast or have just listened to the podcast, over to the right-hand side of the podcast description or anything is an icon that says one-on-one coaching sessions. Click on that button. You'll be taken to a page that describes each of the different 9 sessions I'm offering. They are one-on-one sessions that we can do via phone, Skype, or even FaceTime. They're very action-oriented. We go right to the topic that you want to talk about. And each of these sessions also includes a copy of my book, Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay. So what more could you ask for? You get me for 90 minutes devoted to you, plus my book. So go check it out. See if there's something that could help you as you step out, step up, and step in to living your powerful truth. Take care. I'm Rick Clemons, the Coming Out Coach. I look forward to working with you.
You've just experienced the Coming Out Lounge. Go online to www.comingoutlounge.com to learn more. And tune in again next week for more stories and tips for being true to yourself.